All right, tonight's senior fellowship class is titled Israel and the Ethiopian Experiment. All right, so by way of understanding that there in Israel, there's over 140,000 Ethiopian Jews. When we went together on our Israel trip, you saw them. They're a part of Israeli, part of the fabric of Israel. But their journey has been a difficult one. In addition to leaving a persecution of Ethiopia and many of them walking to Sudan and the various airlifts. And I'm not going to talk about that, but that's worthy. You should Google that on YouTube. There are great videos about that to learn about that. I'm interested in focusing upon their integration or their religious integration. And we're going to get into that. So I'm going to start off with, of course, a video. We're going to go to the videotape. And we're going to learn something about Jewish Ethiopian culture. Okay, let me go to... Here we go.
This is the Beta Israel community, descended from one of the lost tribes of Israel. For thousands of years, they held on to their Jewish tradition in Ethiopia, celebrating the Sikt, a holiday symbolizing the acceptance of the Jewish covenant on Mount Sinai. In the 80s and 90s, their prayers were answered. A series of top-secret operations, coordinated by Israel and the CIA, airlifted thousands of Ethiopian Jews into Israel. Even though most of the Ethiopian Jews have returned to what they see as their biblical home, they continue to celebrate the Sikt holiday. This year, all of Israel celebrated with them.
ביומנים. כל בתי הספר ביום הזה צריכים ללמד על מורשת יהודי אתיופיה, על המשמעות של החג.
So on Israel's newest national holiday, over 4,000 people gathered in Jerusalem to overlook the Mount of Olives in the Old City. They wore traditional clothing and read from holy texts written in an indigenous language.
זה הפעם הראשונה, אחרי 30 שנה שיוצאי אתיופיה נמצאים בארץ, הם קיבלו מעמד תרבותית, הכרה במסורת שלהם. וזה דבר מאוד מאוד חשוב.
זה חלק ממני, מהקהילה, חג כזה שכאילו מימשנו את הרצון של אלו שגם נפלו בדרך לארץ.
ועלינו לירושלים, אז לא לשכוח, אני חייבת לנו כל שנה, להתפלל, לחגוג את החג הסיד, מה שהיה באתיופיה. אני מרגישה ממש שמחה מכל הלב והחווה להיות בירושלים.
About 50% of Ethiopians still live below the poverty line in Israel. And just this fall, the issue of discrimination was raised when 100 Ethiopian children were initially not admitted to a religious school. Despite these social problems, bringing this holiday to the forefront recognizes the importance of Ethiopians within Israeli culture.
השנה שאנשים שלא ידעו בכלל מה זה חג הסיגד ובקושי מכירים את יהודי אתיופיה, עכשיו פתאום הם מתעניינים. הם פתאום רוצים לדעת מה המשמעות של זה, ופתאום אומרים כל הכבוד, אנחנו מוכנים. זה טוב לדעת שיהודי אתיופיה הביאו איתם מסורת ולא רק עולים לארץ ומקבלים עזרה או תמיכה. ההפיכה של החג שהוא לאומי וכלל ישראלי זה תורם צעד נוסף להשתלבות שלנו בתוך המדינה.
החג הזה, הסיגד, הוא הלך והתחיל לקבל את המקום שלו. לאט לאט. בחודש הזה של הסיגד בעצם, זה החודש היחידי שלא היה בו חג. ויהודי אתיופיה, עם העלייה שלהם, הביאו אותם חג בחודש הזה. היום, בכל חודש בעצם, יש חג. בעצם הם סגרו פה שמחה.
This is Sarah Sorcher reporting for Israel 21C. For more cultural stories about it.
All right.
What year was that? Done
that
for the
was
first time.
Okay, so that it was made a part of the included into the State of Israel's national calendar 2008. Okay, so let's just get everybody up to speed because there was a lot being said there. All right, so just very simple. What is a Sigd holiday? What did you grasp from what from the 3-minute clip?
I cheated in Google, and it's I never heard of it. It's the holiday that commemorates when Hashem first revealed himself to Moshe. And it's somehow wrapped into Yom Kippur.
It's 50. Well, they're partially correct there. Get partial credit.
It's idiosyncratic to the Ethiopian Jewish community.
Right, it's their own holiday. It's not. There's no Sigd in Judaism. Current Judaism. All right, whether it be Sephardic or Ashkenazic Judaism. Okay? So, as Simone pointed out, it's connected to Yom Kippur. What they did was 50 days after Yom Kippur, like roughly the 27th day of Mar Cheshvan, which is, in the end of November, typically, they would all go out to a mountain in Ethiopia where they would gather and they would die. They'd read from the Torah. You saw that. Now, their Torah scroll has 8 books in it. The 5 books of Moses, the book of Joshua, the book of Shoftim, and I think the book of Jubilees, which is part of the Apocrypha. Interesting.
The book of Jubilees?
Yeah, is Jubilees, the... yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Do they know when it was canonized in
well,
that book?
Well, because the way that they present themselves, they are the lost tribe of Dan. So they were there prior to the canonization of the Tanakh. they didn't get the memo. They were stuck in Ethiopia. They were there prior to the destruction, or right after the destruction of the first temple.
So they would have had Chumash. And then those were the other 3 books.
And they had some Torah. They have some oral law, a little bit. They're not Karaites. Interesting. But they're like their own thing. And they also, since they were hermetically sealed off from the rest of the Jewish community for the last 2,500 years, they developed their own practices. So this day, the Sigd, which is a big day for them, 50 days after, on Yom Kippur, everybody did a personal tshuva, and then they did a national tshuva on the Sigd day. Instead of do fasting, then there would be celebration, because they felt we need to do tshuva in order to be worthy to be redeemed to go back to Israel. And they still gather the Amon HaNatziv. That's where we had Rabbi Rabbi Menachem Liebtag give his presentation. That's called the Tayelet, the Amon HaNatziv. That look in the southern part of Jerusalem, they gather. That's probably 4,000 people. 4,000 Ethiopian Jews. They bring the Torah. They have the Kes, their rabbis, their religious leaders, wearing those white turbans. You guys caught that? And they have the Torahs, and they have the multicolored umbrellas. I don't know if you caught that. It's part of their presentation. I don't know if you caught the multicolored thing there. So. But there's a lot of different things going on there. So let me just ask you, so another question is, what aspects of the Keth attire, of their religious leaders, show African influence?
Can I ask, sorry about historically, because you said that they claim to have been lost during the...
Lost tribe of Dan.
Right, so that they would have left before the return of Ezra from the Babylonian exile.
Correct.
So do they use a Paleo-Hebrew script? What script do they use?
They use an Ethiopian script.
That's interesting.
Amharic. You can Google. They have, you can check that out. They like to be called Beta Yisrael. Literally means Beit Yisrael. Beta Yisrael. Uh-huh. I want to get into some of the,
It's very interesting how they like orient themselves ontologically into.
It was a source of crisis for. We're going to get into it. We're going to get into that very issue right now. So but I want to build toward that. You guys saw in the video clip on the dais there, leading the ceremony were the men wearing the turbans, those white turbans, and the robes, etc. So what aspects of their attire show an African influence? I'm going to bring up the picture again.
I mean, there's the turban.
Hold on, let me do a little screenshot over here. Here we go. Take a look. That's a Kes. All right. So give me the African elements here.
The bright colors.
Excellent. Very good, Jade. Right. That's a very big thing. That's why they have the bright colors with their special umbrellas. Sun umbrellas.
It's like the opposite of the black hatters. It's like joyful, colorful.
Right. They got the white cool turban things.
They got the Galabias.
Okay, what are those, Max? Translate that for everybody else.
Sorry, the white sort of gown underdressing that he has on.
Nice. Okay.
I mean, there's also the parasols, which would have been sort of a relic of sort of like English colonialism within North Africa.
Good call on that one. That's why it's part of it. But best current African. Stuff going on there. Here we go. Another picture. One second. Take a look. That's a broader shot. So they got the parasols. They got the turbans. They got the special robe on top of the robes. This is dress which is not uncommon in Africa. So the question is, let's go back. We're going to compare and contrast to the Jews leaving Egypt. What do you think the Jews leaving Egypt look like? What do they wear?
Well, definitely more similar.
They walk like this.
They walk like an Egyptian, right? What?
They wore robes.
Okay, so the bottom line is they're probably fairly similar. They wore robes, whether it be white or linen or whatever color. That was the dress of the ancient world, which and still dressed today in Egypt, in Africa. First of all, it's cool. It's a cooler dress. You're living in the hot African sun. The white is reflective. They probably dressed very, very similarly. We don't know how the Jews dressed in Egypt in ancient times, but likely similar. Now, was it important? Now we're going to a more sociological question, and we make a left turn over here. Why is it important for this holiday, the Sig holiday, to be added to the State of Israel's official calendar? Why was it very critical for them?
To make them feel included in society?
Yes. Why
so
would
they are part of society because that's a Jewish holiday. It's practiced by Jews of a certain origin, but it's still practiced by Jews. And all sects of Judaism have their own things, and this is part of our culture as a people. We're not from Ethiopia, but these are our fellow Jews from Ethiopia, and it's an acknowledgement of their holiday and within the state of Israel.
Right, it's a validation as that they're not outsiders. They're not. Right. Something other. They're not these weirdos. And by this becoming an official part of the State of Israel's calendar was very important for them to feel accepted. Now, going back in time, when they were the first possibility of a desire to move from Ethiopia to Israel, the issue came up, obviously. Are they halakhically Jewish? Okay. So, famously, Rabbi Avad Yosef, the chief rabbi of Israel, based upon his research and he wrote a lengthy tshuva, came to the halakhic conclusion, paskind, as they say, that they are halakhically Jews. And they do not require any kind of further conversion. Other people were not 100% sure, so they required of them a what they call a giur lechumra. Giur lechumra means like we're not going to question your you accept the mitzvos. You'll go to the mikvah. If you're a man, you might do hatafas dam bris. You'll do a minimalistic thing. So that was the debate. Now they don't require. Now, how do you think the Jews of Ethiopia who had risked their life to come back to Israel like that responded to that?
You're not halachically Jewish.
Yeah, I was asking, are you halachically Jewish? That's what I would ask. What about that guy or that guy? Or that
right,
blonde hair?
Right,
guy?
So, right. So that.
Is he halachically Jewish? What's that?
That's not what a Jew looks like.
Right, yeah, so that went.
Kind of like subtle race.
All right, so Daphne and Matt, right, so that obviously went over like a lead balloon. But the issue of.
Can I ask, did they make the Russians do that?
Well, yes, yeah. Well, the Russians.
Another Jewish group do that?
Well, the Russians are complex, but
because they're not Jewish,
right? But they're not right. Well, that's not true. Of the million immigrants, there were basically three categories. You have people who are clearly Jews. Category number two, clearly halakhically not Jewish, and then you had these. Did you have cases which were doubtful, where you could not lock down the yichus? You know what I'm saying? So there were cases where they had to do a giur lechumra if they wanted. There are people who are just not Jewish and they got in because of the law of return doesn't organize based upon halachic principles. If you have, it was based upon would Hitler consider you a Jew. So Hitler considers you a Jew if you have one grandparent's Jewish. Now that's not a halachic consideration, but that was the state of Israel is not purely does not. Go exclusively by these halachic principles, which is, of course, a very big, touchy issue, as we just touched upon. Now,
yeah, but Rabbi, like those cases in Russia and other cases, those were like sort of case by case. Here you have like an entire
correct
group, like blanket group from one region of the world by this religious authority who himself, Rabbi Yosef Huber himself, represented a lot of Jews that were really discriminated against in Israel.
No, but so he was.
Their Jewishness—that's not the same as like those other cases in Russia where they were like, doubted. Oh, you're just trying to escape the Soviet Union. You're not really Jewish. Maybe you're
right.
Like your grandmother was 5 minutes. That's not the same.
Right. So the Avad Yosef came out with the psak, which became the principle, which is that they're 100% halachically Jewish and do not require any additional conversion. And that's the law of the land. So now that they're in Israel, let's get a little more spicy because it was a little bit more par. Let's get a little more spicy, okay? So what are they're showing up to Israel, okay? And they're for the last 30 years. What do you imagine? What is the religious challenge? Forget about all the other challenges that they were, farmers, they were living a peasant kind of life in a third world country, coming to Israel, which in many ways is a first world country, and no longer agricultural. There are many levels of problem of their immigration story, but...
Let's not get too far ahead of how developed Israel.
Right, so, but here's the question. What was the religious challenge of the integration into Judaism and Israel's society, Israeli society... That the Beta Israel people faced. What could you imagine without?
Well, Israel is so fractured as it is. Like there's a synagogue for the Sephardim, for the Mizrahim, for the Ashkenazim. It's not like you're coming into a homogenous state where there's one kind of Judaism. Is already like a lot of fractures, and you'll play like just like here. Except I think here it's more of like conservative Reform Orthodox. In Israel, it's like Mizrahi, Ashkenaz. Plus all of the other levels of Judaism, so you're already coming into a society that's a little bit fractured religiously.
Well, that's helpful actually. That's helpful.
Yeah, maybe it is. Yeah.
So, so that's the positive part. But what's really the challenge?
So, if you're saying that they were one of the lost tribes and that they were separated before the codification of, or forget their timing, or like around the time of the destruction of the first temple. then everything that happens after is not part of their history. So all the other holidays, all the celebrations, all the oral laws and things that we follow, all the rabbinical codes that we follow, they have no connection to it at all. They don't know it.
Anna is 100% on the money tonight. They didn't celebrate Purim because they left the Jewish community before Purim. No Hanukkah. Okay.
No Hanukkah
because they were not there for that. Okay. So and again they were not around for the Mishnah. Okay. They missed the Mishnah. So they have all the biblical holidays. They have.
That's amazing.
Okay. So this is like they feel like we've been killing ourselves being, with Islamic oppression and Christian oppression, and we've been battling and fighting to be Jews against all kinds of forces, and we're going to walk hundreds of miles from Ethiopia, and many of our people are going to die on the way to make it to Israel, and we show up to Israel, and what do we find?
You're telling me I'm not Jewish?
Well, it's not just, even if they, even forget about the issue, is that they don't quite fit in because they're not.
Wait, how do you develop a Judaism? Like, you're not within a rabbinical Judaism framework, though, because rabbinical Judaism is sort of premised upon the Talmud and later.
There is oral law. So they're not Karaites. In other words, there is a tradition of what there's a tradition to the mitzvot. They're not just we're making up our own tradition. They had some sense of an oral law, but the codification of the oral law, they left town before that was concluded. In other words, even in the time of the Mishnah, you could go to a town, Rav Yossi Aglili's town, and they're having chicken parmesan for Friday night dinner.
Where's Jesse? I always think of Jesse. Right,
chicken parmesan, because that was not yet before that was fully accepted as that chicken is defined as meat. It was prior view to what we'll call it pariv. So some communities are having the chicken parmesan. And the other people, and that was not.
What did they do with, like, Yom Kippur and other sort of rabbinically...
Yom Kippur is a biblical holiday, and they fast on it.
No, it's a biblical holiday, but the tradition's only laid down within the Mishnah and the Talmud.
No, but the Mishnah... Now, hold on. Here's a very important point. The Mishnah is not creating the oral law. It is...
Just the recording
of it. It is recording of that which was oral. Okay.
So then they actually offer a really interesting comparative study as to what was pre...
Let me give you one example. They maintain, interestingly enough, that you fast on Yom Kippur and you eat on Shabbos, and if Yom Kippur falls on Shabbos, you still eat.
Would have been more like Ethiopian Jews? If we hadn't suffered like all the diaspora, are they our more authentic selves?
They also suffered a diaspora.
But they didn't suffer like.
No, they suffered. They suffered enormously.
It seems that they are more like, I guess, a form of Judaism that wasn't so much, I would say, as affected by the things that happened, like after the fall of the temple, maybe.
Will Halcyon return to the purity? Whatever.
I know it's a very bad form.
Oh, that's a very
romanticizing them. I'm not trying to romanticize them, God forbid, or anything like that. I know they suffer.
Yeah, what are you trying to do? Go back to the Yahweh spider?
All right. So guys, let me retell.
We're so Europeanized and all that. I just want to know.
So Daphne, that's by the way, as Simone has taught us all. Look, we do see Judaism from a Ashkenormative perspective.
So.
And therefore, we also, in other words, it's easy to point fingers at, those people have African influences, but we also have European influences. Okay? It's not like we're the good guys and they're the weirdies. Okay? It's not so simple. You grow up a little bit, it's not so simple. Now, let me ask a much more challenging question.
These aren't challenging already?
No, I'm warming you guys up, and you guys are a little bit slow. You guys are a little bit weak tonight. We got to get, you know, get. Well, I want to hear some more people. That's it. All right. Well, I'm okay.
Here's Emily's putting the hair up. She's getting ready.
All right. Here's a question. Here's a question. What were three possible strategies that the Beta Israel, the Ethiopian Jewish community, can employ in their new home within modern Judaism? There are really just three choices that they have, had and have. Three choices. Just from a perspective of finding, you know, their place within their new home of Judaism in Israel and beyond.
Give it up.
Okay, number one. Okay, so Max, so number one is, I mean, give up, you mean like completely join
the Ashkenormativity.
Right, either become an Israeli Ashka Sephardic Jew, whatever that is, the modern Jew. In order to just join the winning team, join the modern Jewish option of Israel.
MJI.
Okay. One, what other choices? I want to hear somebody else.
You can do both.
All right, so Scott Shapiro, go ahead.
You could do, they could keep both traditions, like a little bit from column A and a little bit from column B, kind of.
There you go. Exactly. In other words, try to don't deny your past, don't ignore your Masoret, but embrace the tradition of Judaism of today, with integrating the Judaism of Ethiopian Jewry of the past. A blending. A new house blend. What other choice is there?
Satmar style.
Yeah.
Right. You think you're Jews? We're Jews. And screw you. We're doing it our way. Okay?
And right, but didn't like every group in a way have to kind of do this? Not every group, maybe the Ashkenaz had an easier time in the sense of like they were already the dominant culture, but I'm thinking of like my dad who came from Lebanon, and I'm just thinking of their stories being made fun of in school. Like everyone had a sort of I think the Ethiopian challenge is especially unique and more challenging because they're integrating into a culture that's already been built up.
Correct. So they're coming in as a distinct minority whose version of Judaism is very strange. They don't look like other people, okay? They don't come with a European perspective. They're coming from an African perspective. Now, again, African perspective is different than an African-American perspective. People, Americans, like birthrighters, are notorious for this. They get off the bus and they go to an Ethiopian Jew and they're expecting, you know, that they're going to speak to a guy or a girl who's like from Selma, Alabama. No, this is not, no. They're from an African experience. It's a different, they're not, there's no, they don't share any common, they don't share Black American experience at all.
Oh,
zero. Zero. And they've come to Israel. And they're being incorporated now. They do join the army, so which of course is a profound melting pot experience. And what Scott Shapiro pointed out is actually what's actually happening. In fact, one of their people, Rabbi Sharon Shalom, is the first Ethiopian Jew to get smicha in Israel, State of Israel, and he wrote a book from Ethiopia to Sinai, where he shares the compare and contrast Ethiopian halacha and traditional, you know, normative rabbinic Judaism halacha, and how he is writing a guide of how a person could, in a certain sense, validate and value his previous tradition while being a Jew of today. And that was a journey he went through, and which, by the way, was, as he shared, was extremely, you know, you have to appreciate that when they showed up, they had basically a theological crisis. Why'd they have a theological, I want to hear somebody new. Why do you think the Ethiopian Jews, when they showed up to Israel, had a theological crisis? a religious crisis.
Well, don't they also have a different form of leadership? Like they have these kind of priests?
Well, Kess, they call them Kesses. Kesses.
Right. Sorry, I missed the beginning. I had.
Yeah.
There's also some differences. Like, I think they don't do Hanukkah.
Right, I mentioned that earlier. Yeah, they don't have they don't have Hanukkah. They don't have Purim. They were not there for that. They got separated from the Jewish community before these events, and those are rabbinic holidays. So a lot of rabbinic law that got legislated during the Second Temple period by Ezra did a lot of legislation during the Talmudic period. Mishnah, they didn't get because they were not there. So imagine you showing up to town. You think like you're like a rockin' Jew, and then you're like, I'm not. I'm like,
it's an identity crisis.
Right, it's an identity crisis, a religious crisis. This is
like, where these awesome side locks come from?
Right.
Yeah, who are these?
Right,
yeah.
and adapting to modern life.
On top,
Ethio Jews with a very primitive.
That's an addition.
Like, the way that they were living.
I don't know. That's an additional challenge.
I got told all these stories in Sunday school. It's like the Ethiopians didn't know how to unwrap their plastic sandwiches, or like they'd pull off their tomatoes from their because they didn't know what a tomato was, and it's like.
Some of it might be true. They
some
were
of the Yemenite Jews went through with like
right. All right. So here's another question: in what way was Judaism of the Jews leaving Egypt like that of the Ethiopian immigrants, and in what way was it an obstacle to accepting the Torah at Sinai? Let me hear somebody new.
Huh?
I'm putting it on the screen for everybody. In what way was the Judaism of the Jews leaving Egypt like that of the Ethiopian immigrants? In what way was that an obstacle to accepting the Torah at Sinai?
Well, both groups had to learn to adapt to a new way of life. They had created their own way of observance, of connecting to Jewish identity.
Yes.
And then leaving that, they had to essentially start from the beginning.
Yes.
And in the case of, you know, the Ethiopian Jews, they were questioning what they learned from the very beginning. Was this authentic? How are we going to navigate this new life?
Yes.
I object to the question. I think you already gave a great answer to the question. The question implies, though, that the rabbinical Judaism as practiced in Israel, though, is a la, you know, Mehashemayim. That's like Torah at Sinai. Whereas,
yeah, like the Ethiopian Jews were like the Jews of Egypt. I mean, they were far more advanced in their Judaism.
They are. No. First of all, they are. I'm saying like. The key point here is the word analogy. In other words, the Jews in Egypt had them. In other words, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov had traditions. In other words, it was a much more oral, family-based system. They didn't have a text. They were told about God. They're told about certain laws. You know what I mean? There was, in other words, the Jewish community that prior to being enslaved in Egypt, before they went to be involved in idolatry, they had traditions of their father. Remember, they are the direct descendants of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So there were family practices. What did Grandpa Avram teach us? Grandpa Yitzchak teach us? So they had a family tradition. There was ideas. It was oral. It wasn't a.
Yeah, I understand, but the Ethiopians had Torah. Like they had.
No, so the, so the but they didn't. But they but as was mentioned.
Compared to the Jews before.
But as mentioned, their sense or grasp of the oral law is very different and little, and it was much more of a very big difference. It's a different feel.
Me and Daphne have a real axe to grind, I think, in this argument, because it's funny, like, but the development of the the oral law within Ashkenazic and Sephardic circumstances, those equivalent to that of Ethiopian, right? Like, it is as developed and as culturally contextual. So to say that, like, the oral law as practiced in Ashkenaz or Sephardic circumstances is somehow corrector or right or something.
Well, so that's a question. There was a major transition points of the oral law that they were not there for. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
A foundational belief is that not only did Moshe receive the Torah from Sinai, but he also had oral traditions about what these terms mean and principles of extraction. But how those things were fully articulated out was a process of development. You know what I'm saying? In other words,
I hear that in some ways, but like, you know, if they're willing to go up to the destruction of the first temple, right? Like, there's a dubiousness to the reconstitution of the Sanhedrin after the Babylonian exile, right? So to say that,
wasn't
the smicha lost at that point in a way that they couldn't come back and put it together the same way?
That's after the second temple. That's the second destruction.
I don't know. It's just to say that, like, the elders of, you know, like, within the Ethiopian community, theoretically at least, right, like, they would have had elders that were as conversant as the populations that went off to Nineveh.
Right. So they had religious leaders who passed on their Mesorah, their tradition. And, you know, we can't go through all the differences. There are certain commonalities and there are clear differences. And part of that is that they were, as a community, they were persecuted. Even within Jews after the destruction of the Second Temple, there were Jewish communities that had been so, let's say their leadership had been killed. So their knowledge of the oral law was very limited and all they had was the Torah itself. The Rambam in his writings talk about there are certain communities due to the persecution, whether it be Islamic persecution or Christian persecution. In other words, how many people do you have to kill before you dumb down a Jewish community? Basically, you kill all the rabbis, you can kill down 5-10 rabbis, you just drop the level of the of sophistication of Judaism down into elementary school. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't take, in other words, not everybody in the Jewish community knows a whole lot, especially in a time without books. It was only manuscripts. And to disrupt a community like that, it's far more fragile. The benefit of we have books, we have recordings, we have ways to preserve tradition in a way that was not possible in the ancient time. All right, let me go on. I want to bring you into our.
I find that compelling.
Okay, let's go on. I'm gonna have somebody read. Who wants to read? Let me have Jordy. You want to read?
Sure.
The Bitter Waters. This is from coming up in a couple weeks. Go ahead.
The Bitter Waters. Moses led the Israelites away from the Red Sea, and they went out into the Shur desert. They traveled for 3 days in the desert without finding any water. Finally, they came to Marah, but they could not drink any water there. The water was bitter, Marah. And that was why the place was called Marah.
Okay.
People complained to Moses, "What shall we drink?" they demanded. When Moses cried out to God, he showed him a certain tree. Moses threw it in the water, and the water became drinkable. It was there that God taught them a decree and a law, Chok u'Mishpat, and there he tested them. He said, "If you obey God your Lord and do what is upright in his eyes, carefully heeding all his commandments, keeping all his decrees, then I will not strike you with any of the sicknesses that I brought onto Egypt. And I am God who heals you."
Okay, so this is a scene. The Jewish people saw the death of the Egyptian army in the splitting of the Red Sea. They travel 3 days. They get to a place called, and there's no water, which of course is a crisis. The length you can go without water is basically 3 days. They may have had some water with them, but you're out in the wilderness in the Middle East. This is a real problem. Okay? So there, you can imagine people are freaking out, and they complain to Moshe, what are we going to drink? And they show up to this wonderful, gorgeous pool of water, and the water is not potable. You can't drink it. It's bitter. It's mara. Okay? So Hashem does a miracle, shows Moshe that he could put in a certain tree, and that sort of functions as a filter, and now the water is able to be drunk. Okay, great. But then there's something very weird. Then Moshe, for some reason, God feels that this is a perfect opportunity to do some teaching of Torah. And they learn a decree and a law, Chok u'Mishpat. Okay? And he tested them. So obviously the question that the Talmud, the Midrash asked, well, what did they learn? What was the Chok? What was the Mishpat? There are a number of answers. I'm going to pick one from the Guide to the Perplexed. Let me have Shana Bavakasha read of the Rambam, Guide to Perplexed, Book 3, Chapter 32.
The first commandment after the departure from Egypt was given at Mara in the following words. If you obey God your Lord and do what is upright in his eyes, carefully heeding all his commandments and keeping all his decree. It was there that God taught them a decree and a law, Chok u'Mishpat, and there he tested them. According to the true traditional explanation, Shabbat and civil laws were revealed at Mara. Decree, Chok, alludes to Shabbat, and law, Mishpat, to civil laws, which are the means of removing injustice. The chief object of the Torah, as has been shown by us, is the teaching of truth, to which the truth...
I guess that, what happened to my thing? Truth of, I guess it's of Shabbat. Where'd it go? One second. I have to find out what that was there. There's some sort of garbling when I copied and pasted there. Yeah, all right, so he's talking about Shabbos. Let me just see what that is.
Yes, to which the law of Shabbat is to confirm and to establish this principle, and we have shown in the treatise. In addition to the teaching of truth, the Torah aims at the removal of injustice from mankind.
All right, I apologize for the mixed up text. Basically, what's the chok? They got two laws. Hashem introduced them to two mitzvot. One is a chok law, a law whose rationale is not easily detected, and that's the law of Shabbat. He teaches them about Shabbat. And the other one is Mishpat. Mishpat teaches them about civil law, or which is to remove injustice. Why does the Chazal, why was that the best introduction to them? And why do they, and then the question number 7, according to Rambam, what happened at Mara? Why do the Jews need to have this intro to Mitzvot before Sinai? What do you say? In other words, if you're going to get the mitzvahs at Har Sinai, wait the 50 days, show up at Har Sinai, you'll get the Ten Commandments, you'll start getting the chapters of, you'll get started getting the Mishpatim laws. Here, there's like a little bit of an intro. They get one of each example. They get Chok. They learn about Shabbat, which teaches about God as creator. And they get Mishpatim, Mishpat, a sense of the of civil laws, which are to remove injustice in the society. Why are they given this 3 days out, basically a week out of Egypt? What do you guys say?
I think it was to completely remove them from Egyptian civilization. Like, Shabbat shows that you're no longer servant of like Pharaoh or Mizraim gods, but that you're keeping this day only for Hashem. And then the civil laws, I'm sure there weren't that many civil laws in Mizraim either.
Excellent. So you're saying as part of their journeying out of sort of like to de-Egyptize them, they're given a couple of mitzvahs. One is that observance of Shabbat, teaching them about the gods of Egypt are not real, and it reinforces that concept, and that Hashem is the sole creator, and he is And that idea has to be focused upon, correct? And the laws of civil law, which apparently you're right, Egypt was not a just society, is giving him a taste, sort of a foreshadowing of what Jewish society is going to be. So that's excellent. So, but why do you think?
I put the Rambam in the chat for you to copy it over.
Okay, thank you so much.
I think something that is worth noting is that this happened in juxtaposition to a miracle, which is bitter waters turning sweet. So why give the teaching, in connection with a miracle?
That's a good question also. That's another good question.
Right.
Okay, 1 second. And Hashem's telling them, one second. All right. In other words, this is sort of like basically what's going on here is, to put it very simple terms, this is what we call an MG Monday night classes. A person who has had no Jewish education can't just walk into, a senior fellowship class. Okay, you gotta ease on in there. So what God as a teacher here teaches them what? How many mitzvos? 2. Why 2? The critical ones. All right? In other words, Shabbat being a chok, and dinim, law, civil law, the number 2. Now, here's an interesting question. Why were these chosen? And name me 3 mitzvot that you would have selected as your... If you're introducing people who do not have a system of mitzvot, what would you have selected?
Rabbi, I was going to ask, isn't there a story with, I don't know if it's Hillel or Shammai, and they're like, can you teach the Torah on one leg? And the one thing he says is, you shall not do upon the other. Well,
that which is hateful to you, do not do unto others. And the rest is commentary. Go and learn, says Hillel.
So why didn't he say these 2? Like, why wouldn't he say keep Shabbat and civil law?
Right. That's a good question. So what Chloe's saying, what the mitzvah that Hillel told the potential convert was basically the mitzvah of Vehatere Chamocha, you should love your fellow Jew as yourself. But he told them in a more easy form. In other words, that which you don't like, don't do somebody else. He told them in a much more easy form, which is, by the way, part of the dinim, part of the laws of civil law of interpersonal relationships. It's part of that. Yeah, but you also might say you may have put davening in there. What else would you have put in there?
I don't know that you can explain hoke on 1 foot.
I think idolatry, believing in God, because hokim, those laws that we don't really understand the reasoning behind, it stems from the principle that there's a creator of the universe whose reasoning goes beyond our understanding. So if you establish the principle of there's one God and, removing idolatry, I think that would sort of be a good foundation to build on the other chukim.
Well, I agree with Adrian, and even more so after leaving Egypt, where it was the society of idolatry. Like,
yes.
Wouldn't that be one of the first,
Here's a question for you guys, which we discussed a bit. Is this the very first mitzvah they ever received?
Rosh Chodesh.
They got Rosh Chodesh. They got Korban Pesach, which we learned a couple weeks ago. They got, in order to do that, they also had to do Brit Milah. So they were not completely at ground zero. And the issue of idolatry was really addressed with Korban Pesach. They were there to publicly kill and consume one of the pantheon of gods of Egypt. So they really had already done that. A chok means that, in other words, either a chok prefer that I don't know the reason of this mitzvah, or I don't know the reason for the form. Here the Rambam is saying the reason for Shabbat is to teach the Jews and humanity about God as a creator. So that's knowable. But why is the best way to communicate that and to keep that part of our civilization, how is that achieved via the Shabbat, you know, taking 1/7 of your life, dedicating that to Shabbat? So that's, you know, or could you have accomplished the Shabbat goal in a different way? Now, why this is the form, that is the unknowability about that mitzvah. You know what I'm saying, guys? So that's the, I think that as Chloe said, Hadrechemoch will be a great one, although dinim, civil law, damages and what is, a good contract, the basic things that what lawyers do all day is to ensure you have a just society, ideally, or make sure you have an unjust society, God, chas v'shalom. So basically, Hashem is giving them a little bit at a time. They've been out of Egypt a couple of days. They had a traumatic experience. Hashem tells them, you follow the mitzvos, I'm going to have a providential relationship with you. I'm going to take care of you. So sit down. I'm going to teach you two mitzvos, Chok and Mishpat. Rambam's understanding, Chok, that's talking about Shabbos. Mishpat is talking about civil law. Because basically it's about Hashem and creating a just society. That's Judaism. That's basically the format of Abrahamic Judaism in its boiled down amount. Now,
why does it come from the Mara story, though?
So I don't want to get into that. I don't have time to talk about that. But that's worthy of an additional point. If I have time, I'll see if I can sneak in at the end. Now let me bring this to you guys as I'll ask you a personal question. How does MG introduce mitzvot and its lifestyle to new participants? What does the MG method share in common with the Mara experience? And what is different, if anything?
I think MG has a very joyful approach to it all. And then you get into this stuff.
The non-joyful parts of Judaism.
No, but the more serious parts. I mean, it's not like a kumbaya, tikkun olam, everything is a Shabbos dinner synagogue, and it shouldn't be, but it starts off with like the joyous parts of Shabbat and the eating and the drinking and the praying and the singing. And then it gets into the more deeper elements.
I've heard it said that the Rabbi Wilds believes that slow Jewish songs will save the entire community.
Well, do you believe that?
I don't know if I believe it, but I believe Rabbi Wilds does.
Right. Well, yeah, I think some people like it, some people don't. Simple as that.
Rabbi Penny's guitar, Rabbi Wilds drums.
That's it.
So how? What's the common denominator? How are they similar and how are they different?
Well, the underlying message that God is your healer. Like, I can see that with people coming into MJE lacking a sense of community and camaraderie and then getting these pleasant experiences. So the underlying message of the story, at least, I can see a parallel with MJE of, like, getting people's basic needs as humans met and in that way.
In other words, the sweet waters.
Right.
Okay. And B is, and then educationally, did Hashem teach them 74 mitzvot? No, he taught them two. And the Torah does not depict how he shared that, but it could not have been a very profound and lengthy and very involved presentation. You know what I mean? It was like a very basic inner experience. It was like a little taste. In other words, so that's where MJE, I think, and the Mara experience is the same. Give people a pleasant, short, little teaspoon. A little teaspoon approach to Judaism. Don't have to commit. No, not big on the commitment. A couple of teaspoons. Obviously, MJE is big on Shabbos. people have time on Shabbos so they can enjoy Shabbos. Not too much on the civil law, though. Not too much focusing on the dinim, on business law and how Judaism, you know, that's not focused upon. It's all, in fact, MG only focuses on the chukim, Shabbat, Yom Tov, Kashrut, you know, Jewish marriage. I try to add to the fellowship and the senior fellowship more of the Bein Adam L'Chaveiro law of Jewish business law a little bit, get a little taste of that. But it is underrepresented, you know. Okay, so what's the pro and con of this methodology?
The pro is to not overwhelm.
Good.
Like tidbits, you know, here and there. And I think also because they came from such a low spiritual place, minus 40, you know, you need time to be ready to receive. And it's also kind of a teaser, like, oh, that's interesting. I want more.
Right.
And I guess the con is, in the meantime, they're not living a Jewish life and they're not seeing the full, maybe they're not connecting on the full level that they could.
Can they? Can a person, I mean, what is a realistic growth?
I mean, that's like more the Chabad route, right? Where it's like, here's a mitzvah, here's a mitzvah, here's a mitzvah, where it gets piled on real quick.
Right, so some outreach organizations will start to amp it up at a much more rapid rate. Now, you know, so again, too much could be overwhelming, and the person will say, you know, this is too much, and I'm out of here. So let me bring a case scenario a little closer to home, because I want to bring out, all my scenarios are literally what they call Maisa Shahaya, things that occurred to me. I changed the names. Jane MG has been observant for 3 years. She meets Samantha, who has come for the first time to a Friday night dinner. Samantha tells Jane that she may have to leave early as she has a party at the firehouse on Columbus Avenue later. Remember the firehouse, guys? Jane feels a little judgy inside as she says, great, to Samantha.
Firehouse?
Yeah, it's on Columbus. Why does Jane feel judgy at all, as she herself would have been doing the exact same thing 3 years ago?
Because Jane wants to go to the firehouse.
But why is she...
Where is the firehouse? Columbus and what?
It's around the block from MG. It's like 87th.
I don't know it.
What year, Rabbi?
What?
What year?
What do you mean?
I don't know.
I feel like dive bar is like the sloppy Upper West Side bar, no?
It's a restaurant and bar.
Shooky loved the Mermaid Inn. Not the Mermaid Inn. What was it at the Mermaid Inn?
That, on the...
All the stories had to do with the mermaid, whatever.
Guys, I think we think Russ.
And anyways,
I think she would feel judgy because if she's been, you know, studying and observing for 3 years, she probably knows you're not supposed to go out on Shabbat and, you know, swipe the credit card or do whatever else you do at the bar. That's and so she feels like she should tell her friend, you know, not to go out and do those things. You're already here observing Shabbat, just stay with us. But she knows she kind of gotta. Let her do her thing.
I think Jane feels judgy because she's doing something very wrong.
What do you mean?
I don't know. If anything, Jane should be more sympathetic than anybody else, because as we always discuss in this class, the idea of the Baal Shem Tov, of the person returning to their Judaism, the person who has tasted the nectar of sin, they should understand more than anyone how difficult it is
This is some kind of defense reaction formation going on here, right? Like, what does someone else's activity has to do to her but to reveal an unconscious desire for herself to be going to the firehouse?
Right.
It's the kind of, like, judginess, like, oh, you, like, it's this judginess that's, like, just because you overcame this habit of going to a bar on Friday nights that you probably had forever up until 3 years ago, doesn't mean that this person, I don't know, it's judginess that I personally can't stand.
So, but I've experienced this phenomena that that MGEers who have been observant for like 11 minutes are rather quick to, you know, they don't say it, but I could sense it. You know what I'm saying? Like they're looking askance upon, you know, like, oh, you know, they know enough to be, you know.
Well, where do you tell them to shove their sanctimonity?
That I'm being judgy of their judginess.
Oh, we can't get out of this.
So I do address it with people. I said, look, you know, why are you feeling like, you know, why is that, in other words, why is that bothering you? In other words, the bottom line is that the judge is coming, it's bothering them. Like they should. And the key point is, and this is, we have only a couple of minutes left, is that the main principle here, going back to the Ethiopians, going back to Hashem dealing with the Jewish people at the early days, is about having a compassion and patience for human development. The Jewish. Hold on one second. I got a whole sentence out, but I'm going to go for two. Here we go. The thing is like this: human development of any kind, it takes time. You cannot plant a seed and expect it to become a flower in a day.
So the Israeli Jews that are judging the Ethiopians, you're saying that they are still a work in progress, that it'll take time for them not to be judgy. So they are the ones that are going to the bar on Shabbat. They're the ones that need time to
I'm saying is that you
relax and expand their vision of what Judaism is.
Well, one second, Daphne. Let me I didn't get to fully unpack it. I only had in other words, the let's take one thing at a time. Hashem recognized that the Jewish people are going to go through a major transformation. And he starts that transformation in Egypt with the giving of the two mitzvot. They witness the makot that teaches them about the power of Hashem and the reality of Hashem and the falsity of the Egyptian pantheon of gods and the falseness of human power. They saw that. They saw the Egyptian Empire army being devastated at the splitting of the Red Sea. And then Hashem is trying to introduce to them the next. He pulls them up a chair after they're being sort of saved by having the sweet water to teach them sort of an overview. If you have to pick two mitzvot, how do you teach somebody? So one is the idea of Shabbat, in the basic sense that we're going to have a day that we're going to commemorate that God is created on a weekly basis. So this idea will be fully entrenched in our people. That's A. And B is the idea that there is civil law. You have to treat people with people have rights. There's a dignity of man, and we have to treat people in that manner. And that's and then he taught them, and the Torah does not articulate those conversations how he did that. So basically, as then they're going to get Shabbat, they're going to have the basic rules of Shabbat: don't gather, stay in a place, don't cook, and they're getting slowly acclimated to a new lifestyle. And Hashem has compassion for the Jewish people to take this process slow and steady. The what happened to the Ethiopian Jews who came to Israel was a catastrophic change for them, both economically, sociologically, and also religiously. And the fact is that they have to be given space to be able to work that out. Similarly, if Jane meets Samantha at the Friday night dinner on the West Side, and she's talking about going to a bar,
whatever you want,
Great, and recognize that you should celebrate the fact that she is electing to make as part of her Friday night coming to an MG Friday night dinner. That's amazing. The fact that she is going to now augment that to go out with friends to a bar on Columbus Avenue. Okay, that's what you would expect. That's normal. That's natural. We got to celebrate the natural. You got to have compassion for human growth, and you can't force growth. That's the basic point. Hashem did not force growth, and we, as following Hashem's footsteps, cannot force growth onto people. and be understanding that things just take time. Okay, that's my basic point. Questions, comments, criticism. You got 3 minutes. Anything you want. Go ahead.
Daphne, go.
I need to shut up sometimes.
I'm going to say something.
Go ahead, Chloe.
I've been like 15 years BT, and I agree with you, Rabbi Penny. I think when you're in the beginning of the process and you're not sure and like, you know, you've discovered this new path and this new love, right, and this new fear, whatever approach people take, and you really want to learn more and grow, and, you know, you've convinced yourself that this is the right way to go, then, like, it's kind of natural in a way to be very judgmental of others. But once you're really living, like, the Jewish life and this is a reality day to day for a long time, when you go to a deeper level and you just know, like, everything that happens, Hashem decides, and everything's for a reason. Like, who's to say that somebody who's not there yet is doing wrong versus somebody who's keeping all the mitzvahs, but maybe we don't know what they're doing in their private homes or not. And I think when you're deeper into it, you really just see everything is from Hashem. So if everything is from Hashem, then different people are at different levels. It makes sense.
Right, so what you mentioned a whole lot of goodies there, Chloe. But I want to highlight one thought that you shared, is that as you become older and more mature in the process, you recognize that it's a journey, and you become much more forgiving. When you're earlier and you're very, let's say, harif, you're very intense, you're very, You also, going back to what Max said, you might feel a little bit, you may feel a little bit uncertain yourself. So therefore, people who are not on board might be, in a certain sense, threatening. And maybe say, look, maybe Jane saying to herself, like, maybe I'm the idiot. Maybe I should be going with Samantha. Maybe I'm giving up, maybe she has the right idea. You know what I'm saying? So it might bring out a need to double down and be aggressive back, because the underlying confidence in her position might be not fully there. So it's...
Yeah, poor Judgy Jane. She's too frum for the secular yids, not frum enough for the Orthodox ones. Gotta be for her.
I also think... Dead, Adrian. I also just had a different idea.
Good.
I think that when you develop in your Judaism and you realize how complex it is, you sort of start to also realize your level of ignorance. And in so doing, become a little more open and less judgmental as a result. When you start out, you're like 1,000% sure of everything. It's very intense. But the more you know, you don't know, right? So I think that also opens people up intellectually and be more forgiving intellectually of others that have different opinions.
Excellent point.
I have to say something. Maybe I'm like a Jewish communist or socialist. I hate the idea that...
No one doubts that.
No, like a halachic... I just hate the idea that there are even levels, you know? It just...
But Daphne, the way that Chloe said, we're not... The only person who can know who's on what level is Hashem.
Right.
In other words, as Chloe said, we see a very small percentage of a person. You don't know what they're doing the rest of their life. You don't know. We can't judge people. It's just
the iceberg. Yes, you're right. Chloe and Tupac.
That's why Chloe got to skip regular fellowship, is because she's got those profound insights.
Chloe, you're feeling the love tonight. I'm telling you that. That's it. Pretty good. So, all right, this is a massive topic, and Jewish integration, Jewish development, growing as a person. It's a complex point, but one thing you see is that Hashem has, there's the Rachmanus Habore, there's the compassion of the Creator, that He did not force the Jews to become the Jews who could stand at Mount Sinai and receive the Torah. He took them through sort of a circuitous route, both geographically and also emotionally and philosophically and educationally, and sort of sequence certain experiences so they could be grown and nurtured properly. You know what I'm saying? They were fast-tracked, but they weren't overly fast-tracked. You know what I'm saying? So that's a big component. So just going back to what we do at MJE, as I always like to say, that there are 70 levels of Shabbos observance. You know what I mean? And each person, as they're growing, you celebrate that.
Good question. Could you have, like, the best level of Shabbos observant, like, next week, and then go back to level one? Like, do the levels, like, always get better and better? Do you sometimes experience one great one? I mean,
there's always ups and downs. Always ups and downs. The human experience is ups and downs. It's just, you know, and I'm not saying you'll be fully, you know, I mean, if you're having these great swings, that itself is worthy of investigation. Like, what's going on? You know what I'm saying? That's an illumination that I need to address. Like, why am I having experience A 1 week and I'm having experience Z the other week? And why am I having this sort of like bipolar swinging over here? I'm having this Jewish bipolar swinging. That should be discussed, should be analyzed and explored. You know what I'm saying?
Where do you come down on, like, Frankelism, though, in that, like, you have to, like, closeness and not judging other and, like, the halacha of it?
I'm not sure what you mean by that. I mean, I think...
Like, how kosher does it need to be kosher?
That's a different question.
Oh, okay.
In other words, it's as far as being accepting and tolerant of people, that's one L. But the question is we, you know, if kashrut, I mean, you know, we do go by legal categories. In other words, if a person is a kosher observant, a Shomer Shabbos Jew, you don't have to have any questions. You sit down and you enjoy the meal. But there, I mean, obviously, if they're frying up steaks and butter, I mean, that's you know, no matter how well intentioned they are, that those are some non kosher steaks. I mean, like, you know what I mean? No matter how, right. You know, without in our,
you're not giving them the leeway of closeness if you're making.
No, I'm just saying. In other words, I can say to the person, look, they're doing the best they can, but those steaks I cannot eat. That's not to say that's
I appreciate that, which is to say, like, there's no, like, closeted saints in some ways that, like, if it's treif, it's treif.
And there are certain objective perimeters. Treif is treif, yes. Yes, it's not correct. There are some, I mean, that's what halacha creates. As I always said many times, halacha is a floor, not a ceiling. And there are certain parameters, you know what I mean? And again, within that person, you know, needs to do the best they can. That's it.
So it's okay to have, like a kosher cheat day?
So it depends on where, that's a good question. So that's... The answer is, like in everything in Judaism, it just depends where the person's at. Okay? It depends where the person's at. And they should discuss that individually with somebody that they trust who can provide good guidance to that. You know what I'm saying? It's not a simple thing. In a certain sense, yeah, there's, you know, a Jew can never, quote-unquote, knowingly and willingly and defiantly eat non-kosher, but in the journey, which is not linear, which is... you know, that's the question. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? That requires close counsel. It's like there's no one answer fits that question. You know what I'm saying?
And there is the concept in Judaism that Judaism recognizes that we sin.
Yes.
And that
yes.
We ask for forgiveness. I mean, every day in the Amida,
yes,
you ask for forgiveness.
Yes, but we can't say I'm going to sin on condition that I'm going to do tshuva. You know that's not a good tshuva.
Right.
Or you can't quote unquote game the system. A person could say like I'm not up to the level. I you know I'm having a challenge with the kashrut that I need to make a little excursion. You know that's something separate. You know what I'm saying? So
there are harder for certain people and
yes.
You take time on. It's not like I intentionally, like, I'm angry at God, so I'm going to have a bacon cheeseburger, and tomorrow I'll take the Amida and I'm all good.
Correct. Right.
That's the Catholic approach.
Right, correct. We're not correct. So, all right, we're on the overtime, so I'm going to, Deb, is Rabbi Wiles joining this? Lo and behold, he's here. Baruch Abba, Rabbi Wilds. Rabbi Wilds, Shkoyach, welcome.
Hi, man. What's going on?
We're having some fun. I'm going to turn the class over to you.
Thank you. Is that a real background or a virtual background?
No, that's his bad. That's literally his left. That's Rabbi Wilds. That's his house.
I got you.
That's right.
How are you, Max? What's going on?
Hey, it's a great confidence bookcase you got going. They should have been taking lessons from you. This man is learned. Look at those books.
You know, you can't.